Transition 2, PlayStation Portable, and PlayStation 3. Sadly, we had to retire the PlayStation 1 server last week. A couple of questions before we start. Firstly, who had less than 4 hours of sleep last night? Okay, so we'll be careful. Okay. Secondly, how many people saw the C++ for new architectures talk yesterday? Good, most people. Fantastic. Okay, well, that talk would have given you some insights into getting performance from the PPE part of the cell, which is the PowerPC type bit that we share with our colleagues in Seattle. However, the PPE is only the first stage in getting the performance from the cell. And now I have the honour of presenting my colleague, Colin Hughes. Colin's been helping game developers since the early stages of PlayStation 1. And he's going to talk now about the synergistic processing element, which is not so easy after 4 hours of sleep, and getting to the next stage of getting the performance out of the cell and the PlayStation 3. So, back to Colin. And before I forget, mobile phones and cyber, please. Thank you.
I just drew one out of last night's equation and I'm excellent on you guys. But I get some presentation again. So I feel really bad for you hanging out with us. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the SD programming. Okay, so for the PlayStation 3, in particular, we've got the main CPU core, the cell broadband engine, and that consists of obviously the one PowerPC core and the synergistic processing elements. I'm not going to concentrate on the PowerPC side of things today. As Paul said, Microsoft had a really good presentation about everything that's wrong with it. I'm just going to concentrate on the SPEs, which are quite important. So I'll go into a bit of the architecture of the system. I'll talk a little about the operating system and the interface in a way that restricts your access to the hardware. And then I'll talk a little bit about some programming on a single SPE, the architecture, how it's used, and I'll move on to some kind of some examples of programming across multiple SPEs, so doing like parallel programming. Okay, so this is the cell broadband engine. Okay, I don't know if you guys at the back can actually see it, it's not very big projection, but basically it's like a parallel system on a chip. You know, we have all these different blocks, the different processing elements. We have the PowerPC in the corner, and we have seven SPEs on the chip in the PlayStation 3. There are not actually eight in silicon, but one's actually allowed to be disabled for yield. And finally, we have the kind of the different interfaces, the RSMs, and other peripherals. But they're kind of beyond the scope of this talk, so I'm only going to really talk about the SPEs. The SPE kind of architecture, it's like a self-contained kind of processor. Basically, you've got three kind of different chunks. In the bottom right-hand corner here, we have a thing called the memory flow controller. That's the interface between each SPE and the rest of the system. It's like a glorified DMA controller, and also handles all of the external interfaces for synchronization, snoop responses from other processors. It's effectively the only in and out path. We then have the 256 code local store. This is just the internal memory for the SPE to operate on. It's actually connected by quite a wide bus to the other parts, like the connection between the memory flow controller and the local store. Even though it's a really tiny arrow, it's actually a 1024 bit connection. So the idea is that when you're doing DMA, the DMA will occur with a very high bandwidth but have a very minimal impact on SPE code. And then on the left, we actually have the SPU, the kind of like CPU core of the SPU. Okay. It's a very simple processor design. Basically, it's a two-way superscalar processor. It takes 32-bit instructions and dispatches them to either an even or an odd execution pipe. And in the pipe, you've got different execution units. The way it's actually designed, we changed the kind of like focus when we go from PlayStation 2, and PlayStation Portable a bit, kind of PlayStation 3. We wanted more kind of general purpose use rather than the kind of the graphics floating point getting performance. So the SBE kind of even byte actually contains calculation units for both integer and floating point. And the odd byte contains the kind of like control logic, the load and store pipes, and the vector wide kind of shifts and permutation units. It also contains the channel control, which it directly controls the memory flow controller. That's one of the other differences coming from our previous architectures, where when we had vector units on PlayStation 2, they were like a slave device. They were given data by the rest of the system, they processed it, but they couldn't fetch anything themselves. The SBE is like a completely general purpose machine, because each SBE can actually instigate DMA on its own and fetch data from anywhere in the system. Finally, we have the register file, which is a set of 128 vector registers, each 128 bits wide. And it's a unified register file. It takes vector ins, vector floats, vector shorts, pair doubles, characters. It's just any type of assert vector 128. When you're actually programming it, on the PS3 we have two operating system models. We have the Game OS, which is the operating system we supply for licensed developers. That's kind of like NDA'd, and effectively it's kind of a secure operating system to make Sony money. And then we have the Linux operating system, which is available for anyone who has a PS3. It's free download, just install it on a consumer PS3, and you have access to all the kind of calculations on the machine. The SBEs are always controlled by the OS. They're not kind of just bits of hardware. They're actually mapped into the OS in both cases as like shared resources with kind of like dispatch control and kind of multitasking. One nice thing in terms of like where you program, SBEs are all mapped into kind of a global process map. So it's like a common multiprocessor, common shared memory architecture. And the way we abstract these individual processors on PS3 for both the Linux and the game operating system is we abstract them in kind of a frame model. But actually the end users, unfortunately we have 7 SBEs on the hardware, but we only allow 6 of those to be available for user code. So this is an example just showing the different memory map. You can see how, at a certain location in main memory, you'll find all of the SBEs mapped with their 256 code local store is actually visible to the rest of the system. So you can have like PowerPC code and poke directly into local store to pass parameters if you wanted to. Or one SBE can be DMAing and it could DMA directly to another SBE's local store. It's all handled by this kind of like common memory system. And also externally, you actually have a view of the control of the DMA registers on the memory flow controller as well in the global system map. So I said about the internals being the core DMA controller and local store. The memory flow controller is actually quite important. It's a conduit between the SBE and the rest of the system. The only model for accessing system resources is actually via a DMA paradigm. This is very different to a classical processor where you have a cache hierarchy. So you'll have your level 1 cache. Any misses will be fetched on a level 2. If they're not present at level 2, they'll then go out as kind of bus requests. For the SBEs and the uses we wanted for, we decided that kind of a fixed local store with explicit fetches from system memory was actually a better model. This is perhaps not as easy for you as programmers, but it's a modern hardware that is guaranteed to get better results because you can actually predict the latencies a lot more. The MSD kind of control controls these individual DMAs, just memory copies to or from the local source and memory. And it actually allows you to queue up to 16 of these. And it's controlled independently of the actual SPU core. So these, all the DMA operations run in parallel with your program code running on the SPU. Okay. In most cases, with careful consideration, you can effectively hide all of the latency of main memory fetches with calculations. Yeah. Said before, the SPU core is like a vector processor. It's only operates on vectors, so everything that every operation is a vector-wide operation. There's no scalar support in the architecture at all. When you actually program for it, you're normally going to write C code, and the C compiler will actually handle the conversion of your scalar C code into the underlying vector model. But for kind of optimization, you should always realize that vector types are best. It's always best making something natively vector. The MFC is directly controlled from instructions. There's no kind of indirection. To actually kick off a DMA operation just takes 4 or 5 processor instructions. Okay, there's no writing to memory management bridges or anything like that, which you may be used to on other platforms. And it's almost completely pipelined. Only a few instructions are not pipelined in the architecture, mainly the double precision floating point operations, which weren't necessary for our current set of workloads. And the instructions that are kind of pipelined all have quite small latencies, especially for a device clocked at this speed. You know, the longest latency instruction is actually single precision flow, 6 cycles, or the kind of branching, which is like a complete pipeline refresh. In most cases, if you want to try and utilize it, high detail instruction rates, then it can be quite easy to do. Okay. In terms of performance, the SPU core on the PS3 is clocked at 3.2 GHz, and its kind of theoretical peak rate is about 25.6 gigaflops. Yeah. That can be achieved in simple algorithms because you often have this kind of paired calculate on load sort. A lot of compute-intensive algorithms, you can really get quite good kind of results. Yeah, you may not get 100% efficiency, but 80 or 90% is quite a good result. Also, the bus connection is actually quite high bandwidth as well. The SPE through the memory flow controller has 2 channels. There's actually a separate out and in channel. Each one of those is kind of rated at 25.6 gigabytes per second. And what's kind of more important, the connections to the local source are so wide that even if you're in a theoretical situation where both of these DMA channels are running at full speed, the actual hit in terms of the local store utilization is about 25%. So for kind of more realistic cases, you'll find in most games or parallel algorithms, you can pretty much assume that DMA is free in terms of the effect on the local store. One negative point is actually the lack of branch prediction. I'll go into that a little bit more later on. But for design purposes, we didn't actually implement any silicon to do dynamic branch prediction at all. Instead, we have a particular instruction in the architecture which will preload a pipeline at a branch. And the idea is the compiler or application programmer, if he knows the way branches can occur, can insert this instruction earlier in the stream and hide the latency completely. We came up with a couple of the kind of mad ideas. We were thinking about what the applications for the SPU is. Because obviously, when we wanted the SP to be a much more general purpose thing for PlayStation 3. And on our previous platforms, the Vect units on PS2, the VFP on PSP, they were very much focused on really specialised tasks. The SPEs are much more general purpose. So we thought about, what can you do? Yeah. Obviously, the first thing you might think of is like the geometry tasks. Yeah. The standard mesh processing transformation, kind of subdivision, even the kind of clipping and culling, they can actually be moved on onto the SPE. It's very suitable for those tasks. But yeah, also, I won't use the procedure word, I think that's kind of copyright Phil Harrison. But we think about kind of the generation of meshes, things like the L systems for doing kind of trees and kind of foliage, you know, or even kind of any kind of fractal stuff to get extra detail to procedurally generate. And animation as well. One of the things we're kind of pushing in PS3 is really for people to use the calculation, the extra kind of oomph in the kind of SP to do more with the animation, not just blend in some canned animation shapes. You know, do more with the physics and so on, and build it in. And other stuff, just texture generation as well. This was kind of one thing we thought as a kind of a helper for the graphics chip. You know, especially on a console, if you're running console back, you tend to be memory bound a lot of the times. And so one of the applications we considered for the SP was a kind of just-in-time decompressor. So we put out textures ready for this, you know, your particular frame that are actually held in more compressed form in high memory. You know, not for any kind of real performance, but just to free up memory, give you some like a bigger kind of palette for your levels. Physics and physical effects, again, they're like another kind of big push from Sony. For the kind of guys who are doing actual development here rather than people outside the console, we really push the physics side. We can give like the Havoc and the GL libraries as kind of as is to the kind of application guys, and you can use it. And we've been working hard with all of these guys to actually make sure that their physics engines utilize SPEs. But yeah, it could be you have your own physics solutions or simpler physics, kind of things like particle systems, you might want to move across those keys. Then, one thing in kind of general, memory decompression. This is actually, again, it's not something people think of as using like a very high capacity flow microprocessor for, but the SP is actually very good at integer operations as well. It wasn't targeted only for flow. IBM, who have small kind of input and design. Their kind of like requirements for cell and SPs were completely different to Sony's and actually hinged on a lot more kind of like data encoding, encryption, and integer based workloads. This means that the SPs are very good at those kind of workloads as well. And then in terms of sound, you know, obviously kind of making music. You know, the software synthesizers, we supply libraries that do a lot of that work. But there's the kind of like processing of the input sounds, another thing that we push in. It's a use for the SPE. You may find that you've got your game running and you're not using the SPE to complete the first generation title. So why not run something that, if you've got your voice chat running, you analyze the sound that's coming in, you change the animation of your characters. So if the guy's chain and he's really hyped up, you can make his character in the more play game like a little bit kind of jerky and kind of generally like a little bit more stupid and goofy if you want. And again, you know, that's just any a signal processing application. There's a lot of stuff on the web that analyzing stress levels in kind of audio which can just be like taken and put into the game. But image-based stuff as well. Yeah. Again, there's one obvious use, which is the image decompression. You know, you use our library to the MPEG, MPEG to MPEG4. But, you know, iToy stuff, doing image recognition, and even kind of, for probably more for the games guys, if you really kind of don't have much time on the RSX to draw in triangles, you can consider moving some of your post-processing into like an SDE job. Okay. It's actually one of the situations where it may not be faster than doing it on the graphics chip, but if you do it on an SDE, you free up the graphics chip to something else, and that could be the difference between 30 frames a second and 20 frames a second. So, when people start programming the SDE, the SDE is supplied with C and C++. So there's a very high-level programming interface to start off with the code of the SDE. You have like a full standard C library. There's even a template library that can be insane enough to use it. You can feel my feelings about C and C++ here. Okay, and C supports vector types natively. It basically supports the Altidec PowerPC vector types. So you can move code that's been running as vectorized on PowerPC, compile it on the SDE compiler, and it should work. But then, for those people who want to go down a little lower and actually work on optimization, we supplied the entire instruction set is available as intrinsic to C. You should really never have to go down to assembly. You may just end up with C that looks like assembly, but all the register allocation and some of the scheduling is actually handled for you. I said before about there being no branch prediction. The nice thing with C compilers, the C compiler knows this, and it will actually generate the correct hit instructions around your kind of like loops and also function calls. So it does a lot of the kind of like the background work to kind of make things optimal. So it's quite easy to get code into the SDE. As long as you can make the code small enough to fit into its kind of memory. So unfortunately you can't make your entire game. That would be a bit too easy. We wouldn't be so happy if we let you do that. So once you get your code in there, it can actually be good enough performance at that point. What I've seen historically, over the last year or so, from people have been moving code, their code, people they're going code from PowerPC code to SDE code, is you may find that once you've got it compiled, it will actually perform better on the SDE than the PPE without any work at all. But that should just be the first step. Because then the thing to recognise is that the SDE is only a vector processor. So if you've taken a part of the code and it's been quite heavily scaled up with maybe a few vector instructions, it's worthwhile looking at it and seeing if you can completely vectorize the algorithm. You can get like a 4x speed up. Not in every case, but in a lot of situations where you're moving code across, there is that potential. And when you're like looking at kind of tweaking the optimization as well, it's worth remembering the SDE is an inline processor, it's in order. So, though the latency of the floating point instructions is 6 cycles, so if you have like a long Taylor series expansion with just lots of dependent instructions, it's going to be lots of these 6-cycle stalls. And it can be worthwhile then looking at anything like that and seeing if you can like break it up into independent chains or find other stuff to do. Or if you can't break up, see if you could just unroll it. Unroll it 5 or 6 times. If you look at IBM have all of their sample code that's actually publicly available, so anyone can download it. And their guys, they are a big fan of unrolling things. You'll often see like their samples just like 6 times unrolled to have the normal algorithm unchanged and doing 6 times as much work for the same cycle count. How many guys are actual PS console programmers and how many are outside the industry? Is there anyone from outside the industry? One guy in the back. This is for you. Okay. I didn't know what the actual background would be, so I had to be a bit cautious. So you can kind of throw things at me and tell me to hurry up. Yeah, so this is just the SIMD programming model for the SPE. It's a very, very simple vectorized process. There's no cross-element operations. So all of the vector instructions pretty much work on independent fields in the vectorization. You don't get any kind of like cross operations like dot product on LMT and vector. Everything's outside. So once you realise this, you have to kind of work on sort of your input data from the common like array of structure approach where your vector is a vector with a float x, y, z, w into something that's more friendly to this architecture. Common one is like an SLA approach where you have like a vector for x, vector for y, vector for z. There is a cost in converting between the two types, but on average it tends to work out that between 6 and 8 instructions to do a 4x4 in one form to a 4x4 in the other form. And if you're lucky, you can often like hide these instructions in some other code in your loop. Especially if you're doing a lot of operations, like you're going to do a lot kind of bug damage. Okay. I'll just touch on kind of the intrinsics. Yeah, as I said before, we cover pretty much everything as intrinsics. So you have kind of conversions between different types like float and ints. You've got all the kind of arithmetic and logic instructions are actually exposed. They actually get exposed in two ways. Again, this is part of the ease of use thing. Although many people say that Sony are never interested in ease of use, we have heard of the concept. Yeah, we don't pay much attention to it, but. So the intrinsics tend to be given in like an SPU form, which is typeless. So an SPU add, if you take a vector flow, the vector flow will generate the floating point add operation. If you give it a vector int, and a vector int generate the int operation. And then we have an SI format, our specific instruction, where you actually have to generate SI floating add or SI word add. And you can use these to kind of like do kind of neat tricks in low level without having to drop down to assembly. And even kind of the channel control, which is the DMA, they're actually exposed as individual intrinsics. We do have other libraries as well, but at the bottom level, for both the game and the Linux. You basically use these intrinsics very low level. For the vectorizing and data, these are the types we kind of support natively. One caution note, there are some incompatibilities between the SPE kind of architecture and the generalized outer deck. We support kind of like an unsigned character vector type, but we don't actually have any instructions that do special general arithmetic. The only instructions we have in the ISA that work on unsigned characters are actually ones that put in support MPEG. There's a sign difference and average. If you've got something that's vector carrying, you're doing pixel work, you need to be careful that you may actually do a kind of vector add and kind of byte array. But the compiler would actually have to generate extra instructions. It's not doing a single instruction to manage your intrinsic. We also support a vector unsigned long, but there's no instructions that actually do anything with it. Most of the arithmetic is going to be on vector ints or vector shorts. Okay. Probably the most useful instruction for a lot of programmers is this one called shuffle. Rather than a generic set of kind of merge and extract instructions, which is something we had on PlayStation 2, We have a single instruction which does a kind of lookup table across two vectors. And this could be used to implement pretty much any kind of cross vector commute. It's a great instruction. It tends to be about 30 or 40% of the instructions in my code are shuffles and whatnot. Coming back to branching again, it's in red this time because it's something to pick up on. You know, there is no branch prediction hardware. So every time you do a branch, there's a kind of like 18 to 19 cycle delay by actually completely reloading the entire pipeline. Okay. So in some cases you can get around this with these the hints I mentioned, but other cases where it's like iffy code, where you've got a lot of conditionals, you should think about whether it's worth computing like both sides of an if and then pre-selecting the data. Okay. But if you do this kind of compare and select instead, you can actually generate code that's completely pipelined. Often you may have stall cycles in your code anyway, and those stall cycles can be used to provide the other kind of extraneous calculation. Supported by the compare logic, essentially generates just a bit field. So when you do a compare, because you're binding a bit field in the vector, which can then be used with either logic like ands or ors, or they can be used with a kind of select bit instruction, which is a nice way of using the compare result to pick between two independent registers. Effectively, it just implements an and mask, or with the and not mask to wasteland. Okay. I've got some kind of like a kind of code sample from some work someone did. This was on it was vectorizing the implicit fields to do lobby metaphors. And he started off implementing this in a Weibull field equation, which is just a very, very simple operation. The main thing he had to do to optimize it was just vectorize it across four results. And these operations were just, it's very good at this because it was four independent points that could vectorize very easy. So you'd start off with using the intrinsic, and we just have our kind of instructions there. So we calculate the difference just with a vector sub, we multiply the squaring, and we generate kind of a dot product. You can see when we move the mouse around. This is where you can't see because I'm not seeing the mouse. Okay. This is where one of the kind of limitations in the architecture was shown, because in this equation you need like a dot product, which is a cross vector operation, but there's no instructions in the architecture to do a cross product. So we have our kind of a vector difference. We now need a dot product, so we dropped into kind of scalar operations. They're not really efficient at this point. So we take our x squared, we're shifting left again, and adding those partial products again, kind of escape. And then we're just working through reverse goes. It would be inefficient to work through the rest of the pipeline. So we have a couple of instructions then to take four of the scalars and then merge them together. Again, using these shuffle instructions. Take the fields from like two vectors and merge into a half vector, and other two vectors merge into half, and then finally get a kind of group of four and half squared results, which then could actually be like calibrated further. And so at this point, we're back into vector operations, we're looking at four points, and we have a situation where in the original C code, it was an if that actually involved a graph. But all we had to do was just set a flag on it. So we replaced it with a select. And this actually gave very nice code in terms of like the instructions. But they're still very dependent. each time I'm kind of like doing one result, and the next instruction is dependent on that. So it's not the most efficient code we have. We'd actually have a situation then where we're actually getting lots of dependency sorts. That particular example was quite a bad one, because it was like explicitly very linear. In the end, we actually unrolled it six times, and we got six times of performance for nothing. But in more kind of complex cases, you do have these kind of stores, but the compiler will actually reorganize instructions for you. It is very good. We've actually spent more time on the kind of SVE compiler, both for the Sony and IBM, than we have on the PowerPC. So, whatever way you're programming PS3, the kind of best code generation you get from our tools is often on the SVE. And we supply a kind of software simulator with our SDK. It's a very good way of actually, if you've got something that's a very tight algorithm, you're just trying to chase that last kind of like 50%, 100% improvement in speed. Put in a test bed, running through the software simulator, and you can see exactly where the stall cycles are varying. Again, it's kind of like, we have a PlayStation 3 internal version of this tool. There's also a public version available from IBM's site for hobbyists to download as well. So we come to the problem of the pipeline. So seeing this kind of interruption, we're wasting cycles. We have this kind of pattern here where we issue our first instruction, our next instruction is actually dependent. So it won't actually issue until kind of 5 cycles, 6 cycles later. And in a perfect world, if we unroll it 6 times, we get 6 times the work done. And it's often is it as easy as just marking a block of code, cutting it and pasting it 5 or 6 times. The C compiler has loads and loads of registers there. Way, way more than you're used to normally. And it's very good at assigning temporaries. Okay. So as I said, the compiler is actually quite good. Compiler allocates registers. The normal model we have for C is that 87 registers are reserved as function temporaries. And I think about 40 or so, maybe 45 are parameters to pass. So it's very heavy use of the kind of register space. It's also very good optimizing compiler. It doesn't need instructions to play with. If you're trying to optimize a really, really tiny loop, the compiler won't generate very good code because it doesn't have enough of an instruction pool to rearrange. It's very hard for it to unroll loop variation. So just kind of doing some kind of unroll manually, following the IBM examples, will often give you a very, very quick speed boost. That's kind of very useful because it's any one program. You don't have to be the kind of red neuro guy who's like used to thinking in cycles. It could just be the AI or even some script stuff where you just unroll some stuff, do some pre-fetching. I mentioned the SP simulator. As I said, how many guys have actually looked at it who've done PS3 work? Okay, I see it's been used well. Hopefully by next year, when you've got your second generation titles, you may have remembered where the SPU is. But it's actually really good, and it's one tool that's very, very underused. When I look at the kind of people access inside, not just Australian programs, but America and Europe, it's a bit of a kind of dark horse to a lot of them. Funny enough, I think the people who are not kind of licensed developers who actually have been looking at Cell and PS3 from the public probably get to use the simulator more, because it was the only tool we could download from IBM site. Okay. Another optimization that's worthwhile doing is the idea of kind of software creeping, like software pipelining. Very simply, if you have a very simple loop, just try and hide the latencies of kind of like loads, number of calculations, so they can wrap around the loop. In this case, we just basically have the load, which has like a 6-cycle latency of an operation, and we put at the end of the loop to preload the next iteration. It's a very trivial example here, but in a lot of cases, for simple algorithms, like a lot of simple maths, like long chain dot products, loop prefetching is often the best way to optimize those. I think it's the case that we'll try and get out of industry benchmark, so because they look really bad on the internet. Okay. Also, the C compiler actually has mechanisms that can hide the branch prefetch even in kind of conditional. If you have a for loop or a while, the compiler will actually insert branch prediction hints to minimize the cost of branches. But it can't do it for if-thens. However, we've got a mechanism exposed in the GCC called built-in extent. This is a kind of like statistical hint to the compiler to tell it which of the paths are true or false path is going to be more likely to occur. And the current SPE compiler will use this to kind of generate hints for the correct path. It will also do some other optimizations. It may change the code flow as well, but in particular, it's used to put branches into the flow. And it can actually be a very good way to improve a lot of kind of branching code. Things you might get, like even Huffington codes. We actually had like the code we were using most in was the MPEG-2 kind of VLC coding, where there was a lot in the core loop and the algorithm. There were lots of if statements to see the bit to the cycle, one or another of the fixed decode tables. And we were able to like look at the kind of frequency of these tables go in an average bit stream. And then basically set the kind of like likelihood of these if thens. So the most common table to be coded would be said, well, this is more likely to be a true condition, and the other ones would likely to be false. And that actually did have a big win in code. If you're doing, you may find that if you're trying to do like a kind of bytecode interpreter, or like scripting language, moving that across to SPE, script, these things are often like very branch heavy because you're trying to interpret bytecode, decide what it is. And the same kind of thing, just like adding the kind of hints to say what's more likely to occur this way, and then tell the C compiler to help with it. There are a couple of pitfalls. Obviously, the main pitfall is in terms of programming, there's only 256 code blocks of memory. This is a real killer because you actually share it between code, data, and stack, and also you have to share it between like DMA buffers. Because you're fetching data explicitly from main memory to local store, you'll often have to buy not just from the side of the data from main memory, but also the local copy of it as well. Yeah, so everything accesses goes through DMA. I mentioned that these memory accesses are via the channel control instructions at very low level. We also give a kind of high-level library to abstract even further. So you have like a DMA library to just say issue a read. It's decoupled when you actually issue a DMA, because it runs in parallel with the SPU, your code can continue to do something else. You may want to like rethink kind of out. So if you're doing like a collision processing where you're trying to traverse your scene database and do ray object extensions, try and like pre-fetch data in the subnodes before you actually kind of calculate. A simple example would be a tree, for example. If I'm just doing a simple AB tree, like that's right. The normal operation is I'll fetch a node in, make a decision as to which subnode, and then fetch that subnode. And that's a very serial dependent operation. So each time I issue a read, I have to wait for the read to come back from main memory, and then I can actually process it. An optimization for the SPE, a very simple one would be at each node, before you do any calculation, issue the prefetch from both subnodes. Because the reads occur in parallel, they'll actually process. You can then go have your logic to assign what subnode is really the correct one. And then only at that point issue the sync to say this one's all I want. Yeah. You don't care about the other one, it just will complete, but there's no need for you to wait for it. And that can be a good way to hide the latency. That can actually be some kind of extended further to try and maximize the number of what you have in DMAs you have in one. Because you can queue off like 16 of them without any kind of stalls occurring. Okay. We have a kind of sample somewhere hidden in our SDK, and IBM have a sample as well, because there are some situations where people do want to have a kind of more familiar kind of environment. So we don't have a kind of cache system, but we do have a couple of reasonably quick software cache implementations. Again, these aren't general purpose. They tend to be for specific operations. So you'll have like a read-only cache that just kind of like allow you to like look to see if anything you want to look at. So your same database has already been fetched into the cache. A write cache would be more difficult to do. And we haven't pushed them a lot with my games developers because they do have a kind of fixed kit. And I personally think that a lot of cases you can actually design for an algorithm to be better, more suitable for a streaming model. It may actually be kind of something that gives a kind of better results than just implementing software cache and then keeping the same algorithm design. So just describe some of the CPU side things in the SDK. There's actually a lot of stuff in the system in terms of its communication. DMA is only the start, because one of the things is obviously we've got like the PPU core, we've got all the other devices, and we've got six SPEs. So at a very low level, we need to have communication between the parallel processors. You can't just leave it to kind of communication via main memory. That's too slow in many cases. So the memory flow controller has lots of extra functionality. Covers like atomic commands. It's mapped very similar to the PowerPC atomics for new sensors. There's mailboxes for communication between the PP and SPE, and also the signal notification register itself for communication between SPEs. And finally, there's actually extensions in the DMA to allow you to do control and basically order your DMAs. So you can guarantee the data is arrived before you kind of send it somewhere else. So, touch on atomic DNA quickly. If you've used like PowerPC architecture before, the atomic operation of PowerPC is a kind of load and reserve and store conditional. These are implemented on using exactly the same hardware mechanism by the SPEs, the memory flow controller. However, because the SPE doesn't have a direct access, the method of doing them a lot is via DMA. You actually have a specific form of DMA read that will actually read 128 byte location from main memory and set a lock on it. You can then process that data internally the symphony, and then you have another DMA operation called a put conditional from attempt to place that 128 byte chunk of memory back into the system, but it will actually monitor the global state, and if any other processor has touched that, you'll install the fail and you'll get a conditional back. So you can use this. This is used in the kind of libraries that implement mutex, it's conditional variables. They're all standard OS of synchronizes. Okay. You also have mailboxes, which are they're mainly like a kind of command chain for like PP sending commands, the SP sending responses. We have a difference between the sending and receiving. So we have like an inbound mailbox on the SPE, and that actually has a 4-gig beeper, and an outbound mailbox which is only 1 gig. The reason for this kind of difference is because of latencies. Across the system, if you talk between one device, like a PP and the SPE, it will take like 100 cycles or 200 cycles for the transfer to go through. So you obviously don't want to be polling on your PPE code because it's a very slow operation. Whereas an SPE is very close to its IMFC, so the latency for the SPE to check its queue is only like 5 to 10 cycles. Signal notification is another kind of communication. This is something for kind of SP to SP communications, and it's basically it's just a 32 location that's memory mapped, and you write to it from an external system device, and the SP can read it. The difference between this and the mailbox is it actually has an OR mode, almost the IDO symbol, what would be very similar to something like an interrupt register. So when something's written, instead of overwriting what's currently there, it all does a binary OR. So you have multiple devices writing and sending bits. Those bits will be collated, and the SPE can then do your one read and capture the current status of the external world. It's very, very useful if you've got an algorithm where one SPE is explicitly waiting for data from like 4 or 5 other SPEs. They can then send the flags, like different flag region and region bit, and the SPE can just like hold and waiting for all the bits to be set. I think I'm running a bit late, so who wants to have a really boring DMA synchronization? I'll kind of rush a bit on this one. There's one really important thing with the PS3 model, especially with the parallel processors, and that's that at the bus level, it runs what's called a weak order model. What that means is that if you were like measuring absolute time, if two processors actually send data out, the data is actually not guaranteed to get to arrive in the order of send. Anything on the bus, there could be like reorganization. The bus manager could decide that a path is available between these two and not the other two. There could be like refresh occurring of the RSS or the access, but there's no guarantee of order. And even if you actually send data from the SPE or you read data, there's no guarantee either. One example could be like I read data from like a 4K block from main memory to my local store, and it could be that the first 128 bytes of that block are in XDR memory, so they're 400 bits cycles away. The next 128 bytes of that block are actually held in the level 2 cache on the PPU. So those second 128 bytes will actually arrive 200 cycles later. The first 128 bytes will arrive 400 cycles later. And they actually appear in the community local store how on order. So some of the tricks that you may have actually implemented on kind of PC or older things, where you can kick off the DMA, you know the DMA is going to be linear thing, they're not. not guaranteed work. So it's really important that there's actually a way of controlling the DMA and setting up, like, so you know when a DMA is actually finished. We implement this with the tags, maybe. Because we have like 16 DMAs active, you don't want to like just say have all the DMAs finished. You knock it down to a subset. And the idea is that you set every DMA is given a tag ID, and there's a flag you can read at any one time. So the status of all the 32 tags. There's another mechanism as well, actually, in the DMA, which it's a way of doing synchronization where you don't actually have to monitor the DMA from the MFC like you do yourself. That's called a dependency barrier. They have a subtle difference. If I hit your fence on that third operation, what it will do will guarantee that these first two DMAs have to complete, okay, before that third DMA starts. However, there's no guarantee at all. The fourth and fifth DMA calls can actually complete any order. So the temporal order could be something like the first one completes, then the fourth one completes, then the fifth one, and then the second one completes, and only then the third one be allowed to start. Or it could be the first one completes, the second one completes, then the third one's allowed to start, then the fourth and fifth complete. Now, if you want something stricter, you issue a barrier instead. And a barrier will actually block it completely. So it says whatever's occurred before temporarily has to complete before it starts. And only once I start can anything afterwards in the queue start. So as you start to do like power algorithms, even though I'm doing data transfer, it's very important to do that. I've got a couple of slides, some uses of like some stuff about how to use more for less views. I think I'm probably very behind time now. Okay. The most simple, this is the most simple way, and this is the stream processing is the way that most people are used to running code processors like the Vec units on PS2, and also the vertex processing model. You're doing the X9 shading, you'll be running stream model. It's basically like independent data, like a block of data coming in, a block of data coming out, and some processing that works only on that data. The extension for the SPEs is you tend to have explicitly assigned streams and power units. So in this case, we have a sample showing three SPEs running the stream. We have a flow where in the first cycle, we pre-fetch data. In the second cycle, we're actually fetching some data, doing the processing. And by the third cycle, we've completely primed out a stream, and we'll be getting parallel operation of like the DMA in, DMA out data, and the processing. A lot of people, when they're moving things like Python systems regulation, you'll use this kind of model. One thing that's important, though, is you need to actually be doing enough work. In some of the practical situations we've seen, people haven't actually been doing enough work to hide the embedded latencies. So they've been DMA bound. It's taken more time to put the data in and send data out than it has to actually do the processing. And it's been quite surprising how much work you have to do, or how bad your code has to be. Okay. Okay. There's one other model that's a little bit less useful, but if you've got a very, very complex kind of process, rather than having a streaming model, which is like a memory to a processor back to memory, it's worthwhile looking at a pipelining model, or if not simple, maybe not quite simple pipelining this, but a directed acyclic graph. Something where, rather than sending data to and from memory, the data will come in at one point and it will be DMA directly from one SPE to memory to another. And this plays well to some of the strengths of the system because there's a really, really high interprocessor bandwidth. It's way higher than any one processor.
something and say, that's a cool subject collision on CUSDU, generates a possible intersecting object pairs, and then throws them out to a group of SDs, each one doing like polypoint intersection. So it's very much a pipeline to go with nodes of fixed calculation. However, what most people would probably end up doing is this kind of model. This is the kind of general purpose model of the job theory model. And we support it with the PHP Whispers library. There's no public library for it, but IBM have code. And the idea of this is you actually break up all your work into tiny independent jobs, almost like batch cards, a whole kind of like postal press email that sees in column 6, which always uses the break all my code prize young. So these jobs run independently. And the nice thing about this model is it's very general purpose, it scales quite linearly with the number of SPEs. So, for an example, PPE is like adding jobs to a queue, and when there's processing resources, these jobs are run immediately. But we get to a point where we haven't actually had these stores, and then we get something where it's busy. So, job E, job F, brand is in the queue, there's no processing resources. But as soon as one of the SPs finishes, it self schedules, fetches the job off the queue. It's a very, very good system for independent work. There are kind of problems with it. It's not perfect, but for a lot of things where you can kind of fire and forget, and you don't have immediate chains of dependencies, the job queue model is going to be the best way to program these things. But it's not the only way. There may still be certain algorithms like a necessity to go to a different model or even like a fourth model. We actually had one example. We were running the ocean simulation, and this was it's a really, really computationally intensive model of ocean dynamics based on a test and door survey. Okay. So what we did, we took the algorithm and we thought about how we can do it on the PS3 and SPEs. And the way we decided to actually implement it, after showing you those three models, we didn't actually implement this problem there at all. We decided this particular way, it was so computational demanding, that the best way to implement it is actually to do a data parallelism. It actually helped the fast Fourier transform, especially using 2D, is a very, very data parallelism anyway. So we split across four SPEs for our test. We ran the same algorithm across a partial set of data, completely independently, without bits of memory. And then in the second part, we'd read the memory with a different data partitioning to the second stage. Okay. It was quite an interesting thing for comparing the absolute performance, because we started off with a simple simulation of 2 to 6 times 6 grade. The test code, when we run like the original test and Dorf code, we run it on like an Athlon 4800. So it's a reasonably fast machine on Linux. And the performance we got with that was like 17 frames a second scale of code. We then moved it across to cell, and with the same code, our performance was basically 15 hertz for a single SDG. So we'd actually managed to match the PC performance of this mathematically intensive algorithm with one SDG. But with data parallelism, we can actually get the frame rate up 60 hertz before. Yeah, so that was like the initial optimizing measurement. Then we went back and we can optimize the fast Fourier transform spectralizing. And it was very much like a big, big improvement. So the final vectorized code ran about 120 hertz on a single SPU. So that's you know, about 8 times faster, and it also scaled across, so the same kind of algorithm they've scaled and optimized for 4 SPUs is running like 460 hertz. It's like good PR for Sony, good for something. Make up all those other things where people say, oh, we're not quite as good as like that. But this is just like really emphasize one of the things that we're pushing, where it's all the really, really computational sort of logic, the things that you might not consider doing even on a high-end PC. There will be things that you are doing on PC that will run really slowly, but you should be able to make up for them with other things that could like much more better than I can. Like this kind of like wave sims comparison with every other GPU network thing, just like dumps on them from a really great height. So I kind of like running on a bit, just saying that in conclusion, we've really been pushing this thing that the SPEs are everything in the PS3 is all about SPEs. CPUs are rubbish, okay? SPEs are absolutely wonderful, but we've not made it very easy for you. Like, some of the size of the hats give you indications of where you'll be tearing your hair out in the next 6 months. Okay? The programming model is more complex. Like, even just a simple stage of changing, like, pointer accesses to DMA is going to give you kind of headaches. And then when you actually get into, like, actually using parallel things with kind of synchronization, there's a whole new world of pain. Okay? But, you know, there is a really good reason why the hardware's been designed that way. Okay? The hardware's designed to have this kind of like very fixed latency model. And it's kind of not very good for general purpose code. But what it does, it will allow you to actually achieve much, much better utilization of the system when you really kind of work with it. You know, the fact that you don't have to worry about having cache misses your habit for SDE code, because you've explicitly had to prefetch data, means that you can write code that's going to be much more predictable and tune in. You'll find that even if you're working on an RPC or a 360 or your PC, if you're trying to really tune an algorithm on a big data set, you may find you're going down to data cache prefetches anyway. And those are kind of like very similar to having to do the DMA model. And this is probably another area. There's a big thing about, we don't want it to just be one small part of your project. We like everything you like, you know, even the kind of like the 16-year-old YTS or trainee you've hired really kind of front end should be running kind of like stuff that's made onto an SPE. There's a thing about, even if you write bad code, it's still going to run pretty well compared to DB. And in this case, it's running on a parallel processor, so it frees up, you know, the other CPUs and final CPUs. You may find, like there could be a situation where something actually runs more slowly on YSP, but a really, really branch heavy algorithm. But you could then move it across to gain some time that way and still have a net win. It's going to be a fun 5 years. Okay? So, I don't know if there's any questions.
There are essential, so we just need to.